You know the story of Icarus, the unfortunate fellow who flew too close to the sun on wings made of wax? Well, NASA is planning to send a much more robust chap into the very atmosphere of the sun. How do you protect a spacecraft from such an extreme environment? And what do we hope to learn about our star? Find out now. It's all new and all blue. Join us. We're joined by Dr. Nikki Fox from the Applied Physics Laboratory at Johns Hopkins University in Maryland. She's the project scientist for the Parker Solar Probe, scheduled for launch in 2018. Dr. Fox, welcome.
Thank you.
Before we get into the mission, I'd like us to get to know a little bit about you. How did you become project scientist for Parker Solar Probe? How and when did you first get interested in solar physics?
So I think I've always been interested in physics. I've always liked to know how things work and why things work. And I always liked science even as a young kid. But this particular mission, I was actually the deputy project scientist for a different mission that was actually studying the Earth's radiation belts. And I was enjoying doing that. And I got asked if I would be the project scientist. And the first time I was asked, I actually turned the job down. I was obviously insane because I was, you know, working on the other mission at the time and I didn't feel I could leave them. And then I got asked a second time, and the second time I said yes. And so I've been with the mission ever since.
And was it as a child that you first got interested in space and astronomy and physics?
Definitely. From a very young child, actually, my dad he was fascinated by the planets and space and particularly manned space flight. And so he was always telling me facts about space. And I think that was where it first started.
I seem to recall a story where you were in the crib, I think, when Apollo 11 landed, and he actually made you watch.
He did. He got me out, scooped me out. I think it was in the middle of the night or something in England, and sat me there and gave me a little running commentary. And that's why he takes full credit for my interest in space science.
That's quite an imprint. Well, this mission has quite a long history. It's began long ago with lots of twists and turns on the way, and it recently just got renamed. Tell us first about the genesis of this mission.
So actually, I think this is one of the most interesting parts of it. It was actually first proposed in 1958, so it predates NASA itself. There was a committee that was chaired by John Simpson, who went to the University of Chicago, like our now namesake, and he chaired it, and it was there to basically give advice to the newly forming agencies, so NASA, the National Science Foundation, and also some of the DOD activities in space as well. And they came up with 12 missions that they wanted to fly that, you know, needed this big national agency and a big infrastructure. And, you know, you couldn't just do it from sort of one institution. And of those 12, Solar Probe was one of them. And it's the only one that has not yet flown. And that has nothing to do with, you know, it not being popular or it not being, you know, cutting edge. It's had many incarnations, but it's only recently that our technology has actually caught up with us and allowed us to be able to fly this very daring mission.
Well, and now it's called the Parker Solar Probe. I believe it was called Solar Probe Plus before. And that's pretty amazing because Eugene Parker is a living person. Can you tell us a bit about him and why naming the probe after him is appropriate as well as historic?
Yes. And as you say, it is historic. It is the first time that NASA's ever named a mission while someone is still alive. And so that is just, it was amazing to be there and be part of it. But Gene basically, he kind of discovered the solar wind. I mean, you know, people knew that there was this wind, there was this sort of atmosphere that was moving away from the sun, because you can see that comet tails always point away from the sun, regardless of which way they're moving. So, you know, they knew there was some atmosphere that was streaming away, but he kind of came up with the mechanism for, like, why it was there and how it was there. And he posited several theories and kind of really raised this to be such a interesting topic. And so it's so fitting that he had this honor. And in fact, there's less people have had NASA missions named after them than, you know, it's less likely that you'll have a NASA mission named after you than it is that you would win a Nobel Prize. So it really is a big honor.
And do you know him personally?
I met him for the first time last week when we renamed the mission, and it was a huge honor. He was a very, you know, sort of humble, quiet, spoken person. And it was just lovely to watch him become quite overwhelmed by the honor. I think particularly when I got the pleasure of handing him a scale model of the mission, and it was the first, obviously the first model of the new mission name. And he got very choked up, and it was really lovely to be part of it.
Wow. I find that to be quite wonderful. Who decided to do this?
So actually Thomas Sabukan, who's the associate administrator for the Science Mission Directorate at NASA. It was really him that pushed. I mean, you know, everybody in the community wanted the mission to be named for Gene Parker because, you know, our science is all based around this seminal work that he did in 1958. And I think the whole community really wanted it to be named after him. But it was really Thomas Sabukan who kind of pushed it through and made us be, you know, able to do this before, or, you know, while Jane was still alive, and do it also before the mission launched, which is quite unusual too, to rename for somebody before the mission launches. And so it was kind of a double thing, not just to have the honor of seeing, you know, the smile on Jane's face, but also that they did it before it was launched. So it was very meaningful.
I think that's lovely. Well, you launch hopefully next year. Give us a mission timeline and tell us, you know, how close the spacecraft's actually going to get to the sun and when that's going to happen.
So we're moving very fast and we go straight to work. We launch, and then just 8 weeks after launch, we encounter the planet Venus for the first time. And we actually use Venus to do gravity assists. Now, most people are used to you doing a gravity assist and actually take, you know, accelerating so that you swing past Jupiter and then you're going much faster on the other side. We're actually doing the reverse. We're using Venus to sort of trim our orbit very accurately and allow us to just get a little bit closer to the sun each time we fly past Venus. And we do 7 of those flybys over the duration of the mission. But so our first one is 8 weeks after launch, and then we have another 8 weeks, and then we're right in at the sun. That's our first closest approach. So just 16 weeks or so after the launch, we are in the full environment of the sun.
What are the big science objectives that you hope to accomplish with the probe? Tell us about the mysterious nature of the solar corona and how you plan to study it.
So they're very simple questions, really, that we want to go and answer. There's these sort of two mysteries that surround the sun. So you mentioned the corona, so this hazy atmosphere that you see during a full solar eclipse. That area there is actually hotter than the surface of the sun. So the surface of the sun is just shy of 6,000 degrees Fahrenheit. But the corona itself gets up to about 2 million degrees. So, you know, that almost breaks the laws of nature. If you have a heat source like the sun, one would expect as you moved away from it, like, you know, if you moved away from a burner that was going, it would get cooler as you move further away. With the sun, there is this mystery where as you move further out, it suddenly gets so much hotter. And that, you know, there's no theory, there's no proof that actually can explain that right now. People have got many theories, and you can explain maybe how it could get hot for a little while, but to maintain this inferno of 2 million degrees compared to the solar surface is a total mystery to us. And then the second question really is in that region where we see these unbelievable temperatures, all of the solar material that's in that corona gets suddenly energized, and it accelerates away from the sun at an, you know, huge, about 1 million miles an hour. You know, and you think you've got that great big sun there, you'd expect everything to remain constrained to that huge body, but it doesn't. This huge energization happens and it moves out, bathes all of the planets. So we all live in this sort of solar wind, in this solar atmosphere. And so we actually feel the effects. So, you know, I like to say if the sun sneezes, the earth will catch a cold. So whatever happens on the sun when there's a big event, the earth will feel some effect. And so these, you know, there's practical consequences to these two questions, but they're very simple questions. Why is the corona so hot? And why is there a solar wind?
Well, let's talk about the spacecraft itself, and what are the main instruments that are going to be flying on board, and specifically, what will each of them be investigating?
So they all have obviously their own roles, and together they form this amazing laboratory that we'll use to test our theories and to sample the conditions there. We have instruments that basically do all the magnetic and electric fields. So, you know, they measure any little wiggles, any changes in the strength of the magnetic field. The sun is a very highly magnetized sun. And as the solar wind is moving away, it actually, when it gets energized, it carries the solar magnetic field with it. And so we want to be able to make sure we're measuring that field properly. The same with the electric fields. They'll also measure plasma waves. So a bit like your radio waves, they're waves that are going on in the plasma. And that can tell you a lot about the processes that are going on. In addition to the fields and waves, we also measure all the particles close to the sun. We have a suite that looks at the lower energy, kind of the what we call the bulk plasma. It's if you think about the ocean, that would be the water. And then if you had some surfer that was going across the top at a higher energy, that would be the higher energy particles that move through the solar wind. So we have a suite that measures the bulk solar wind plasma, and then we have one that measures these high energy particles that kind of surf on the solar wind. And they're usually associated with big flares on the sun or shocks in, you know, when something's moving faster than the solar wind around it, you get a shock. So we have, you know, this full suite of particles. And then we have a instrument that actually is taking images, but not images like you would think of, you know, pictures of the sun. It's a very highly specialized imager, and it's taking pictures of what we're about to fly through. So it's being able to image the solar wind for really the first time at this resolution, so that we can sort of see the structures, and it will help us to better understand the data that we're seeing from the other instruments.
A question that just occurred to me is, do you think that while you're making these measurements in situ close up to the sun, that will be coupled with what we're seeing like by the Voyager spacecraft out at beyond the heliopause, out at the very edge of where the solar wind ends, and the New Horizons spacecraft? Do you think there'll be like a coupling of, you know, what we see up close and what we're seeing far away? Is that a fair question?
It would be hard to see the coupling in sort of real time, because it does take the solar wind an awful long time to get out to the outer heliosphere. But you can certainly see ripples and things in the solar wind, and you can tie them back to events that have happened on the sun, you know, days, weeks, months before.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. You know, you would see the events happening, and then what would they be like later on as they've traveled all the way through the planetary system out to the edge?
If you imagine a tsunami in the ocean, and that would be something that's happening on the sun, and then, you know, by the time it's getting to the outer reaches, it's kind of like the ripple on the beach of the end of the wave.
I guess the most obvious question somebody listening to this might be wondering right now is, how do you keep the Parker probe from turning into a modern day Icarus? How do you shield sensitive scientific instruments from such an extreme temperature and radiation and magnetic environment?
Very, very carefully. We have a heat shield, and that is one of our major technology breakthroughs, is to be able to design this material that makes up our heat shield. And we had some NASA technology money in the mid 2000s to go away and study and design a material that would be able to not only withstand these huge temperatures, but the orbit of Parker Solar Probe is, it goes very close to the sun on one side, but then it comes out around the orbit of Venus. So it actually has a big temperature differential. And if you think, you know, if you take a metal and you heat it up and cool it and heat it and cool it, it will become very brittle. And so we have to have something that will withstand those tremendous temperatures. The material itself, the heat shield, is so good that even though one face of the heat shield will be at about 2,500 degrees Fahrenheit, the instruments on the body of the spacecraft, which are effectively in the shadow, are working at room temperature.
You're listening to Blue Dot on North State Public Radio in Northern California. I'm Dave Schlom. After a short break, we'll continue our interview with Dr. Nikki Fox, project scientist for the Parker Solar Probe to be launched in 2018. Stay with us. Thank you. And we're back. Let's continue our conversation with Parker Solar Probe project scientist Nikki Fox. I'd like you to give us a perspective on how close the probe will get. You know, say compared to the orbit of Mercury, how much closer will it be than like the previous record holder, which I understand was the Helios probe in the 1970s?
That's correct. Yeah. So we'll be well inside the orbit of Mercury, and we'll be about 7 times closer than the current record holder. But, you know, I know that doesn't really give you much to go on. So if we'll be below 4 million miles above the sun's surface. And again, that doesn't sound particularly close, but if you put the sun and the Earth a meter apart, Mercury would be about 28 centimeters roughly from the sun. We will be in at about 4 centimeters from the sun.
Yeah, so that's relatively very close.
Very, very close, yes.
Why is it practically important to conduct these investigations of the near solar environment? You know, not that learning for the sake of pure research isn't a great thing in its own right, but what kind of practical things could we gain from this?
So from a practical point of view, the Earth is basically sitting in the solar wind. So the solar wind is streaming continually away from the sun. It bathes all of the planets. As I mentioned, it carries the sun's magnetic field with it. We have our own magnetic field here at Earth, which protects us from most of the activity and most of the radiation that comes from the sun. But there are times when the magnetic field being carried in the solar wind is in the opposite direction to our own magnetic field. And as we all remember from school, opposite poles attract. And so when that happens, the two magnetic fields can literally join, and it allows all the energy and a lot of the particles from the solar wind to come into the Earth's magnetosphere, or our sort of magnetic shield that we have. When that happens, big scale configurations change in our own planet. And we have beautiful aurora. So you see the northern and southern lights. It can pump up the Van Allen radiation belts. So now we're looking at, you've got a lot of radiation in the vicinity where a lot of our spacecraft live and work. And so we can have damage to our spacecraft. Also with the aurora, you're essentially looking at a current that is floating over your head, and currents always need to close somewhere. So if you happen to live in an area where the ground is non-conducting, this current will look for somewhere else to close, like a power grid or a deep sea cable or a long pipeline, something that's, you know, very easy for a current to flow through it. And that can cause much damage to these very sensitive technological systems. Obviously, we have GPS. We all rely on our GPS. That will become a lot less accurate when you have these big solar events. So there are practical things that affect life and society here on Earth. And Solar Probe will be able to really make a big leap in that research. If you think about it, we're sort of filling that missing gap. We've had spacecraft that have worked in the solar wind, have gone, as you already mentioned, inside the orbit of Mercury. And we have tremendous solar observatories that are looking at the sun in all kinds of different wavelengths. It's almost like, you know, you've looked at the sun from every single angle. But this region where this big heating occurs, where the corona is so hot, where the solar wind is born, we've never been there. And so we really can't do accurate models of how what we see on the sun changes in this sort of black hole region. And so that's where we need to go. And it's almost like the last piece of the puzzle in the sun-Earth connection.
Learning about the solar corona is particularly topical right now with the upcoming total solar eclipse coming this August. I would imagine you've made plans to observe that. And if I might ask, where will you be in the path of totality?
Well, I'm actually very excited because for once I will be on the path of totality and not in a TV studio. So I'm very happy about that. So I'm going to be in Nebraska. I'll be at Homestead National Park. NASA is doing a wonderful job of arranging activities and all kinds of public events all down the path of totality. And they have a big event in Homestead National Park. So I'll be there supporting that for, I think, three days, actually, Saturday, Sunday, and the day of the eclipse itself on the Monday
morning. And is this your first total solar eclipse?
It will be my first eclipse, wow. Total or otherwise. This will be my first eclipse. I'm extremely excited.
Oh, I bet. Yeah, it's going to be mine too, so I'm right there with you. I will be in Eastern Oregon.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah. So very excited about that. As should everybody be. I hope everybody that can get to the path of totality does so.
Yes, I do. It's the first time in 100 years that a total solar eclipse has been visible from the United States. So it's very exciting.
So I recall, you were talking about the effects this could have on the power grid, that there was a big event that happened in the mid-1800s. What if something like that were to happen today?
So yes, it was 1859, and we call that the Carrington event. And that's actually very significant for several reasons. From a solar scientist point of view, that was actually the first time that we realized that what was going on the sun actually had a profound effect on the Earth. This astronomer, Carrington, an amateur astronomer, in fact, was sketching sunspots on the sun, and he was looking through his brass telescope and sketching, doing his daily sketch. And while he was looking, he saw these bright flashes of light on the sun, very, very intense. I think he called them fireballs on the sun. He ran to get somebody to say, gee, look at this. And by the time they came back, it had disappeared. But just a few hours later, compasses on Earth actually began to spin. And then the aurora was seen down sort of around almost as far as the equator, which is extremely, extremely rare. And the whole telegraph system went down in the US. And so, I always like to say that's the Victorian version of the internet. And that was down for many days because of this huge event. And that was the first time we realized, gee, something big has happened on our star and the Earth is actually really feeling the effect. So a lot of studies and a lot of work have been done to model what that would do to today's society, because obviously we don't just have a couple of telegraph lines. We're all constantly on our phones, we're glued into the net at all times. And so the estimate has been a couple of $1 trillion of damage should it hit when the eastern seaboard was around the midnight time. It could cost, a couple of $1 trillion, and the parts of the U.S. could be without power for up to a year. So it's a very, very significant and somewhat scary thought.
That is almost unimaginable.
But that's why we do these missions, so that we can go and take this data and make our ability to predict and forecast and warn so much better. And the Office of Science, Technology, and Policy a couple of years ago put out a space weather action plan. And we call this big, these events space weather. And they've called for the agencies to start working and come up with an action plan of what would we do if we had these big events? What kind of measurements do we need to take? So it's a very significant time for Solar Probe to be launching and providing those last few, it's like those last few centimeters on that meter scale, but they are the most critical few centimeters that we're going to be going to explore.
For you personally, what do you most enjoy about your work on a mission like this and learning about the physics of our nearest star?
So working on missions for me, I love being in a team, Solar Probe in particular has the most incredible team. And this mission, because it's been around it will be 60 years when we launch since, it was first suggested. If you just think of the thousands and thousands of people who've worked on some version of this mission or a proposal or an idea over that 60 years, it's just a tremendous honor to be kind of representing all that hard work over six decades. And so working on this mission is just a pure joy. As for learning about the star, it is our nearest star, so we can actually go visit this one. It's taken us 60 years and it's not going to be an easy visit, but we are going to go visit it. And once we've learned about our star, I hate to insult the sun by saying it's just an average star, but that's how we describe it. There are many, many other stars that act in exactly the same way. So what we learn about our own star is then applicable to, stars throughout the galaxy. So it's a just an amazing mission. And it's a voyage of discovery. We're going to a region where we've never been before. And it's really the last region of our solar system to be explored. And I would say, maybe I'm biased, but I would say it's the most important part of our solar system to go and explore. And any time you're going to go on this voyage of discovery, and you're going to find wonderful things that we haven't even thought of yet. We'll answer a couple of questions, but we'll generate hundreds more questions. And that's what makes this job so wonderful.
And that's really the nature of science, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And do you still have your Beamer?
I don't. No, I have children now. So I actually needed a back seat. When I had my my little two-seater, it was just me.
Aw, well, the kids are important. And I thank you for being with us today. I really enjoyed talking to you about this mission. And best of luck with everything over the next year.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Now it's time for a Blue Dot Eclipse Tip, designed to help you enjoy the total eclipse of the sun on August 21st, 2017. Of course, getting into the path of totality that stretches along a 60-mile-wide path from the Oregon coast to South Carolina is the ideal way to experience this celestial spectacle. But what if you can't? Well, all is not lost. You can still view an incredible deep partial eclipse. I saw one in 1979, and it was really quite fascinating. But you do need to protect your precious eyesight. Do not try to DIY this or use welder's goggles. Only four U.S. manufacturers meet the NASA-recommended international safety standard for eclipse glasses. I purchased a set of 10 solar eclipse glasses for my family from a company called Rainbow Symphony on Amazon for about $10. Make sure the ones you get are ISO certified. You can also see interesting views of the eclipse by projecting the image of the sun on paper or pavement through a pinhole in a piece of cardboard. You can even see interesting effects by projecting the sun onto a surface by interlacing your fingers. And be sure to look at the weird patterns under leafy trees. Very interesting, entertaining, and safe. Whatever you do, do not look at the sun directly without using actual solar eclipse glasses. Film, smoky filters, etc. Just don't cut it. Your precious eyesight is too important to risk. If you are lucky enough to be in the path of totality, be ready to whip those glasses off at the moment the sun is completely covered. You don't want to miss that for the thrilling 2 minutes that it will last. So stay safe and make sure you catch the Great American Eclipse from wherever you are on Monday, August 21st. Thanks again to Dr. Nikki Fox, the project scientist for the Parker Solar Probe Mission to the Sun, set for launch in the summer of 2018. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in beautiful Northern California. You can check out this and past episodes at mynspr.org, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Follow us on Twitter at NSPR News or me at Dave Schlom. Our communications coordinator is Casey Gardner. Manning the controls of the good ship Blue Dot is our engineer and producer, Nolan Ford. And as always, we remind you that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.